is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network. We'd like to thank our sponsor today, Hearst Ranch. Well, today is themed as our Food Blogger Showcase, Part 1. And I say Part 1 because I'm sure we'll be covering food blogging on other shows, too. And I'd really like to hear from our listeners about your favorite food blogs and bloggers for us to have on as future guests. But today, I'll be talking first with writer and blogger Julie Powell about her Julie Julia blog project, how the Julie and Julia movie is affecting her life, and what she's up to next. Then we'll hear from organic farmer Carol Ann Sale this week about her early forays into blogging and her current gig as a blogger on the Atlantic Monthly's Food Channel. And then we're lucky to have food writer and blogger Lisa Fain in our studios today to talk about how and why she started her blog, The Homesick Texan. And finally, we've tracked down Boots in the Oven blogger Logan Cooper to catch up with what's new in his and his blogging partner Rachel's blogosphere. So we'll take a short break and be right back with our first guest, Julie Powell. Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You are listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and this show is brought to you today by Hearst Ranch. We're very excited today to have Julie Powell as a guest on our show. Julie and her Julie Julia blog project were the inspiration for the new movie Julie and Julia, written, directed, and produced by Nora Ephron and starring Meryl Streep and Amy Adams. Welcome, Julie.
Thanks. Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Your now famous blog project, cooking your way through all 524 recipes in Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking, seems like a monumental and totally crazy idea. How did you decide that this is what you wanted to do for your project and to blog about? And why did you pick this book and why Julia Child?
You know, it was really... First of all, it was sort of a panic attack. You know, I was 29 years old. I was living in New York, as I had been for quite a while, in a sort of dead-end secretarial job that gave me no pleasure and no sense of accomplishment. And so I felt really stuck. And at the same time, I had been a sort of, I would say, enthusiastic rather than accomplished cook for several years, and also a person who had wanted to write and felt stymied in that ambition, and you know, I was looking down the barrel at 30. And it seemed like the end of the road for me at the time. And it all sort of came together in this sort of midnight panic attack of, okay, here's Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Here's a book that has been a sort of totemic object in my life since I was 11 years old, not as something I would cook out of, but as a book, as an object, as something to read and think on. And so that would be my subject, and I would write about it, and my medium would be this newfangled blog thing, because this was back in 2002, when blogging was, of course, in its infancy. And so I just sort of impulsively decided, utterly irrationally, obviously, that this was going to be what I needed to do to sort of turn my life around. So I, you know, at midnight I said, hey, I'm going to cook my way through Mastering the Art of French Cooking. And by 8 o'clock the next evening, I was making my first recipe.
Wow.
And just sort of went from there.
So that's amazing. Okay, I have to ask you this. In the movie, you're played by Amy Adams, mm-hmm. And I have to say she is adorable. In the role,
isn't she?
And after having read your book and your blogs, mm-hmm. there are many, many positive adjectives that I can use to describe you, but adorable, maybe not so much. You know, so do you think of yourself as adorable?
I think adorable is not maybe the very best adjective ever, honestly. and you know, and that's just something that you get used to. Well, I am in the process of getting used to is seeing that when you watch the movie, and I've seen it a couple times now, so I'm beginning to sort of breathe through it and realize that the Julie Powell of the movie is a character. She's a fictional character based on Nora Ephron's imagination, who shares my name and some of my traits and some of my history, but she's an awful lot sweeter than I am. I'm not nearly so nice.
So how would you describe yourself?
How would I describe myself? I feel like I'm in a therapy session.
No, you don't have to go into anything long about that. But
No. But
you've got a great sense of humor. I just want to say that it's very fun to read your books.
Well, thank you. In comparison to the character, and I'm definitely more. Well, Amy got this hysteria down pretty well, and the drive during that year. I think she did a really great job with that. But for one thing, I curse like a sailor, which when you're in a PG-13 movie, you cannot do. And for another, I'm a little meaner. I'm a little pricklier. I'm not such a nice girl, actually. I try to be. I want to be, but I fail on a regular basis.
So, let's see. In fact, the only curse word in the whole movie is uttered by Julia Child's husband, Paul. And I thought that was a riot, after having read the book.
Yeah, it's the PG-13 thing. You get one F word, and I hate saying F word. I hate that. But I understand that I'm on air, so I can't say what I want to say. You get one. For every movie, if you want to make it PG-13. And so you have to be really careful about where you place it. And Stanley Tucci got his, and I actually love it in the movie.
It's very great. Yeah, it's very unexpected.
It does mean that the Julie Powell character gets none, and that at some point she has to actually say on screen, quote-unquote, the F word, which I personally were not constrained by, FDA regulations of communications regulations would never say that. I would never say the F word in real life. So that irritated me a little bit.
Well, Julie, you've inspired a legion of followers and admirers with your project, and including our Edible Austin cocktail columnist, David Allen, who started his own Dale David project after he had just been so awestruck by you, where he set out to make all of the cocktails in Dale DeGroff's Craft of the Cocktail book.
Right.
No, but here's the thing. He only made it through about a quarter of the way through the book, like about 125 recipes out of some 500-odd in the book.
Well.
And I think that the thing that's so powerful about what you did and what helped launch your career was that you finished this project, that you finished all 524 recipes in the time that you said you would.
Right.
And so I'm really wondering how hard was that? Were there times that you thought that you wouldn't make it?
Well, yes. There were actually not as many times as you'd think because, for a couple of reasons. First of all, starting a blog, and especially when I started a blog, it was a much smaller world, and I quickly gained a readership. And my readers were sort of insanely devoted and just would so encouraging. And if I was thinking about quitting, they would scream at me until I stopped thinking it. And they were amazing. And I never could have gotten through the project without them. I couldn't have gotten through the project without my husband, who was, extraordinarily supportive. And I couldn't have gotten through the project without Julia, who's, the one thing about Mastering the Art of French Cooking is the tone of it is so encouraging and exhorting. She really makes you believe you can do it and almost challenges you to do it. So all of those things were factors. I will say that one of my, they always say that your greatest strength is your greatest weakness, and I can't decide if this is a good personality trait or a bad one, but I tend to, in moments of stress and trauma, choose impossibly ridiculous things to add to my routine to make it more crazy, and somehow that kind of gives me peace. So you know, that was what I was doing. I was like, oh, hey, I'm in this terrible dead-end job that I'm working 10 hours a week at and spending my life miserable and I have no future. So, hey, what should I do? I should cook my way through this cookbook. You know, it doesn't make any sense, but it made me happier. It gave me a sort of a life buoy. But that said, I, of course, had moments of doubt. And I have one moment in particular that really stood out, which was, because when you're doing the really scary stuff, when you're doing, you know, the stuffed duck that you have to bone and stuff with pate and or the, you know, souffles that are very delicate, that's like the Indiana Jones stuff. That's fun. It's exciting and you sweat and you're trembling and it's cool. And that you don't doubt yourself then. When you doubt yourself is when you're doing something totally pedestrian that you should know by now and it doesn't work. So I was doing a sort of cauliflower watercress puree, and it was completely simple, and I should have been able to do it in my sleep, and it wasn't working, and I wound up just having a complete breakdown, just like on the floor, cauliflower all over the place, the food mill in pieces, you know, everywhere. I was literally banging my head against the back of the door jamb, you know, sobbing, wailing, keening, and my husband, Eric, took me by the shoulders and said, no, you know what? We're not doing this anymore. I can't take this. The project's over. We're done. Because I can't put up with you being like this anymore. And for about 10 seconds, it was like, okay, wow, you're right. I could just quit. And it was this lovely lightening, you know, this great lift of weight off my shoulders for about 10 seconds. And then I said, you know what, I'm going to keep going with this thing. It was like just acknowledging the fact that I could quit meant, you know, and that it was my choice to go forward meant that I didn't have to quit. And from then on, I really didn't have any more crisis points.
About how far through the project was that?
I would say 8 months, 9 months, something like that.
So have you ever eaten cauliflower since then?
I have. I have not eaten cauliflower watercress puree. But I'm actually quite fond of cauliflower. I eat it.
Well, what was your favorite recipe from the project? And do you still cook anything from the book?
It's very, very, very difficult to pick one favorite dish because, of course, there are many, many lovely things in it. And secondly, of course, I don't cook like this every day anymore. But I do go back. You know, I go back for a few things. I go back for the sort of what I think of as the core of the book, which are these sort of long braised stew recipes, very classic French country cooking examples, such as bœuf bourguignon and coq au vin, and there are easier ways to do that. Other people will give you easier recipes, but her recipes are so precise and lovely and authentic that working through them is just this sort of study you know, it's like watching a master at work. And it's like an apprenticeship. So, I love going back to those when I have the time and the patience. I also make the baked cucumbers quite a bit. That's my sort of regular go-to.
Great. I wanted to ask you one thing about writing. Amanda Hesser's article in the New York Times really broke your story to a mass audience, and it seemed to be one of those, that pivotal moment, perhaps, that made you famous, and at least it opened up the opportunities for your book, and
definitely,
then and also which led to the movie. And now that you've written a lot more pieces and a lot more widely read pieces, and you wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times, actually, too, I think. How do you feel about that power, the power that voice gives you to affect other people's lives and to make change, to be a change maker in that way?
I mean, I'm humble. I don't know. When people say they're humbled by things, it always sounds like bullshit. But I understand that's, first of all, I'm thrilled that print media still has that capacity to change lives and to change things. And the fact that it was Amanda Hesser's article that made everything sort of turn around is absolutely the truth. And I mean, it was built upon a year's worth of people, you know, building support online, but ultimately it was that article that made everything explode. And I think that that's a great tribute to the continuing influence that print media has. But you know, when people come to me and they say that, you know, that they've been inspired by what I write, it's, you know, and I hate to say this because it feels like I'm being self-aggrandizing or something, but I'm really, really moved by that, and I really hope, because Julia inspired me to do this thing that wound up changing my life, and I didn't know that's what it was going to happen when I started, but it did, and that if I can, you know, if and when I can inspire people to jump off a little cliff of their own, and or rather jump into a rabbit hole of their own where they don't know where they're going to wind up, I hope that my book can do that from time to time, and I hope the movie can as well.
Well, and back to the movie, you said a little bit about what you thought of the movie. How has Eric, your husband, and your friends who were also portrayed in the movie, how they reacted to it?
You know, they're a little freaked. I mean, Eric's freaked out. He's sort of kind of hiding until the movie's done. I've shown it to a couple of my friends, and they're a little more actively thrilled. Everyone's pretty excited. Eric as well. He's just excited from a distance.
Did it catch his character?
Very much so. Chris McKay did a fabulous job. Really amazing, actually.
It did seem to follow, you know, the book, the way he's portrayed in your book. It did seem to really catch that. That was a great performance.
The voice was really wonderful.
Yeah. Let's see. I've got one question about what's coming up. I know that you have been spending some time learning how to butcher, and that you've got a new book you're working on about butchering, I suppose.
Yes, that's correct.
So how is that going? And when will we see that?
My book, Cleaving, it's called. Mm-hmm. It's another food memoir. It's about my 6-month stint apprenticing at a butcher shop upstate, and it is coming out in December. And I'm really excited about it. So that's my next big thing, I hope.
Well, that sounds really exciting too. So the other thing I just have to ask you is, where do you eat out in Queens?
In Queens?
Mm-hmm. Well, when you're there. I know you're touring a lot right now with the movie.
Yeah, I mean, my neighborhood place is Tournesol, which has been there for a good long time. It's a really great little French bistro. It's fantastic. But Queens is, I mean, there's so much to eat. There's the great Chinese food in Flushing. There's Bukharan food. There's Greek, of course, from way back. It's the best borough for casual ethnic eating that there is. It's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Do you and where do you shop? Where do you find yourself mostly shopping for food?
Honestly, there's actually a new fancy grocery store in Long Island City, but basically I'm always at the Whole Foods at Long Island in Union Square.
Uh-huh. Cool. So the whole thing again that just is so amazing about your project was your fortitude and your accomplishing it without really knowing ahead of time what it was going to bring to you.
Right.
Since it's brought so much, do you feel like it's changed? I mean, it's obviously changed things in your life, but did you come through that 29 turning 30 with a whole new kind of perspective? Thanks
definitely,
to this project, or did you kind of, do you still feel much the same way you did before?
No, you know, I mean, what the project gave to me and what you know, Julia gave to me and what my own experience, you know, brought for me was that you know, the world is always, there's always something new over the horizon, and you're not going to recognize it, and it's a much more unpredictable and therefore sort of glorious place than I had thought it was. You know, it's really a matter of understanding that opportunities are lying there on the ground, and you may not recognize them. They may look like little gray pebbles, but they're out there, and that's sort of a wonderful new way of living that Julia kind of gave to me. And it's hard. You have to keep remembering that that's the way it is, and that you're not in this sort of narrow corridor of experience, and that there's, you know, you're wide open. But that's sort of the big win I got from the project.
So to your devoted bleeders, as you call them, your blog followers, I know you're still blogging. What relationship do you have now with your blog, and are they the same bleeders that you had back in the Julia project? Are they still following you, or have you acquired a new family of bleeders?
I blog on a much less intensive basis than I used to, and on a much less intensive basis than most you know, sort of professional bloggers do today, but I've retained my old friends, and they're around, and it's sort of, for me, the pleasure of blogging at this point is sort of keeping up with the old friends. You know, if I gain some new readers, that's fine, but blogging isn't really my medium anymore. It's more of a, you know, a place to sort of keep track until I get my new book out, because I really do consider myself a writer now, like a book writer now.
So you said the book will be out in December?
December 14th.
That's really exciting. And then you'll be doing a book tour, I assume?
Yeah, I hope so.
Okay, well, keep in mind that there are edible community publications in almost all the states
all
now,
the place,
and two
yeah.
in Canada. So
okay.
I just wanted to invite you to feel like you're, you know, our home is your home in all of the different places where we are, and we would love to entertain you, and if we can help in any way set up food events, things like that, we'd be
okay.
very happy to do that for you.
Excellent. I'm sure that we will be taking advantage of that. Thank you.
Great.
Okay.
Well, Julie, thank you so much for being with us today. I really enjoyed having you on the show.
Yeah, no, it was fun.
Good. Well, and good luck with everything.
Thanks so much.
We're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and this show is brought to you today by Hearst Ranch. Thanks for joining us. We now have with us, again, organic farmer, writer, and blogger Carol Ann Sale. She and her husband Larry were early pioneers of organic farming here in Central Texas, and Carol Ann has been an eloquent spokesperson for organic and small family farming over many, many years. In addition to farming daily, she's a book author, magazine columnist, and has an avid following of her weekly Farm Stand newsletter, and which is what we want to talk to you today about. She also blogs weekly about farming on the Atlantic Foods Channel. Welcome to the show, Carol Ann.
Thank you, Marla.
Carol Ann, first take us back about 20 years ago. When and how did you first start blogging?
Well, it wasn't quite 20 years ago, but it was in the last century. And we had just started opening our farm to the public, but the public numbered maybe 10 people. And so, but they all had internet. They had email. And so I thought, well, I will send them messages through the email just telling them what produce we would have. And I did, and that went on for about a month. And one night, we had a horrible massacre in the hen house. And I thought, well, since they like our eggs, maybe I should share with them that there aren't going to be any eggs for a while. And so I gave them the story of what had happened that night, in great detail, of course. And they all wrote back and expressed horror and concern and all that. And so then I thought, well, they want to know what really goes on the farm. And so that's when my newsletter, blog, whatever, started. And my blog is not on the internet except for some examples. It's mainly by people just asking for it, and then I email it to them.
So how did you get your blogging gig at The Atlantic? And by the way, people can go to theatlantic.com to find your blog, and you click on channels, and then you click on food, and then you can find the food voices of which you are one. But how did you start? How did you get that?
Well, I guess I'm just outspoken or something, but actually it involved Edible Communities, Edible Austin, at the Texas Book Festival. I was one member of a panel with Carby Cummer as the moderator, and it was about local food and all, everything that we're interested in here. And at first he kind of ignored me and talked to all the other panelists, and finally, since I was the oldest one, I had encouraged all of them to get into business. Finally, the question came to me, because they kept saying, she's the one that encouraged us. And so finally, he talked to me. And then, of course, during the whole conversations, I stepped on him a couple of times. So I guess he thought I was feisty enough that maybe I would be a good blogger for the Atlantic. I don't know. But a month or two later, he wrote me and asked me if I would be one. And so I joined an illustrious group of people, including your former interviewee, Julie, and who now blogs also for the Atlantic. And so I've been blogging for them for several months now, and it's been fun.
Well, that's great. I remember that when Corby Cummer met you, and he told me that he loved your voice and the way you expressed yourself and the way you talked about farming and you know the whole local food movement. And so, what do you specifically write about on your blog? What do you try to get across?
Well, it's kind of a slice of life on the farm in a way. I'm not on a big grandstand or anything. You know, I've been asked about a couple of occasions by them to write about the food situation in the country, especially that concerning keeping chickens and eggs and food safety laws and so forth. But really, I'm just trying to share with the readers across the country what life is like on a little farm, especially a little farm in Texas. Every area has its weather woes. And while the Northeast and the North are all drowning in water and blights and everything's rotting, we're like in a desert down here. And so there are different views and different experiences on the Atlantic blog, and this is just one of them, and I'm just in this niche of talking about how it is down here on the frontier. But basically, it's just to tell them what's going on in farming, small farming.
And what are some of the things that you've gotten? I know that blogging these days, you have the opportunity to get people commenting back. And what are some of the things you found that people seem to comment the most about from your blog?
On the Atlantic?
Mm-hmm.
Well, basically, I haven't had very many comments. I've had a couple of them that said they were happy to see my blog, which that made me happy, of course. And one challenged me on my interpretation of the National Animal Identification System. And so he acted like he knew more about it than I did, although he did not have any animals. So I talked to Judith McGeary of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, and I told her what he'd said, that I was wrong in my interpretation. And she wrote in a comment and said, no, that I was totally right. So that was that's the biggest scandal, I guess, on my blog on the Atlantic. It's just somebody disagreed with me, and then somebody else agreed with me. So that's about as rough as it's gotten, really.
Well, but that's also a good conversation starter and a good place to have people discussing ideas and getting different opinions and clarifying things. As you said, you were able to clear up a misconception, and I think that's one of the nice things about the back and forth that happened on today's blog.
Another nice thing that's happened on the Atlantic is that the Huffington Post picked up my blog on eating native greens, purslane and amaranth and lamb's quarters, and so they referred back to my blog on that, and that was kind of a highlight for me because they're famous and so forth. So.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a nice thing that has happened. And not that it was controversial, but it's just, it was picked up.
So how do you find time to do all of this? I know that you're a real farmer, farming every single day, and you have two farm stands, farm markets a week that you put out, and you manage many acres of land. And how do you find time to write your news? I've always wondered how you even did your weekly newsletters, much less now a blog.
Yeah, well, I'm working on that right now. Actually, Sunday afternoons and Monday afternoons are my writing days, and I have to get my website in order because I update it every week and put new color photos on it and so forth, and I write my newsletter, and I try to get a couple of blogs done for the Atlantic so that they can have something to choose from. And it is difficult sometimes to do all that. Thankfully, in the heat of summer right now, I can't really stay out there all day long. I'd be dead. So I farm from about 6:30 in the morning to about 12:30 or 1, and then I come inside and do the business of the farm plus some of the writing. And to make it worse now, Larry and I together are doing a book about growing things down here in this area and the challenges and just how to grow vegetables down here on the frontier. So that's going to be a big project, and that's added to the blogs and the newsletter and the website. So I don't know how I'm going to do it.
Well, you are doing it, and that's the amazing thing. You really, if our listeners out there would like to go and read your blog on The Atlantic, again, go to theatlantic.com, and then click through channels to the food section, and you'll find all kinds of good bloggers there, including Marion Nessel and Carol Ann and many other great voices, including Corby Kummer himself. And so go enjoy, and if you're lucky enough to live in the Austin area, sign up for Carol Ann's newsletter. It's a real delight.
Well,
so, Carol Ann, thank you so much for being on the show with
you,
us Marla, again.
But actually, the newsletter goes all over the world.
Oh, even better.
For.
So sign up. It's a wonderful, inspiring piece of writing that Carol Ann does every single week, and you'll learn more about farming than you ever knew you wanted to. So.
Well, thank you, Marla.
Okay, thanks so much, Carol Ann. We're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back in a minute with homesick Texan blogger Lisa Fain.
I love you, a bushel and a peck, a bushel and a peck, and a hug around the neck, a hug around the neck, and a barrel and a heap, a barrel and a heap, and I'm talking in my sleep about you. About you. 'Cause I love you, a bushel and a peck. You bet your pretty neck I do. A doodle-loo-loo-doo. A doodle-loo-loo-doo. I love you, a bushel and a peck.
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and our show today is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. I'd like to welcome our next guest, Lisa Fain. Thanks, Lisa, for joining us today.
Thank you, Marla, for having me.
Lisa, you're described on your Twitter page as a Texan in New York City who loves to cook.
That's true.
And I also noticed that you have over 2,000 followers on your Twitter page, so I'm very jealous. But, when did you start your Homesick Texan blog, and why?
I started the blog in, I think, August 2005, but I didn't really, I mean, I always kind of liked the name Homesick Texan. I've lived in New York City since 1995, and I guess since I've lived here, I've really identified with the fact that I am a Texan who is not there. And I started the blog, and it wasn't really clear what it was going to be. I mean, I wrote about things like Wes Anderson and 9/11, and it was just kind of all over the place. And it wasn't until August 2006 that I got my first digital SLR camera. And I'd always enjoyed taking pictures of food and things I made. And so it was at that point that I realized, you know, I was always cooking Tex-Mex and, you know, trying to do barbecue experiments and things like that. It was at that point that I realized that it was going to be a food blog, and it was going to be a food blog about, you know, a New Yorker and Texan a Texan in New York who's trying to cook Texas food.
Yes, and that's very much what you're doing now. Your blog is very specific, almost a DIY of cooking, a do-it-yourself guide. It's beautifully illustrated. You are very, very good with that camera. So it's this beautiful, beautifully illustrated how-to guide. And it actually, it's this approach that you have that's inspired the new column that you're going to be writing for us that we're very excited about in Edible Austin called Handiwork. And that's debuting in our fall issue that's about to come out in a couple of weeks. But one of your most recent stories on your blog that I was particularly, I found particularly fascinating was about making cow's head barbacoa.
Oh, yeah.
could you do us a retelling of that for our listeners here?
Sure. Barbacoa in Texas is, of course, from a cow head, and it's something that you find, especially near the border, you know, you find it all over the place. So it's a Sunday, it's a weekend thing, but it's not necessarily super special. But here in New York, when you found barbacoa, it was always made with either lamb or goat. You never found the cow head barbacoa that I grew up with. And then secondly, you can't even buy a cow head here. It's illegal because of, what is it, mad cow disease. So first of all, you know, there was two strikes against me. There, I couldn't get a cow head, and the fact that you can't find it in any restaurants. But I have a friend, Elizabeth Carmel, who is the chef at the Texas barbecue joint here called Hill Country. And she, you know, having access to all sorts of kinds of meat, she told me that she would be able to get a cow head. So me and Elizabeth and my friend Kat Kinsman, and we decided that we were going to smoke this cow head overnight, and so we did at Hill Country, and it was...
Wait, back up just a second.
Sure.
You got a cow head.
We did get a cow head. Elizabeth Carmel was able to get us a cow head that... Through normal channels, I would not be able to get. You know, like in Texas, you can go to Fiesta and, you know, there's cow heads. But here, you can't find that because it's illegal.
So, I mean, no, right here in Texas, as you said, you can get them right in the butcher section of your meat department at any major supermarket.
Definitely.
So if someone is listening in the New York area and they want to recreate this recipe, which I'm gonna ask you more about in a minute,
mm-hmm.
You have to have a special connection to a farm, it sounds like.
Yes, because actually I had spoken to another friend, and she said that she could probably get one upstate from a farmer, but you're not going to be able to get one through normal channels. Like, I'd even gone to a couple of the beef, the ranchers that come to my Union Square Green Market, and they were like, no, we're not even going to touch that, you know. I mean, it's because it is against the law here in New York State.
Mm-hmm. So go on. I didn't mean to...
Oh, no, that's fine. So anyway, I had never actually cooked a cow head, and it was just pretty incredible seeing this thing. And the cool thing was, it was all women doing it, and half of us were wearing skirts. So we were in this restaurant, and all the guys were all like, ooh, oh my God, that's so nasty. And we're all like, yeah, we're cooking a cow head. So we cooked the cow head. We smoked it for 24 hours, and we ate it, and it was great.
So back up again. You said you cooked the cow head, and so how exactly did you do? Let me just read the ingredients from your recipe. It says the ingredients for smoked cow head barbacoa are one cow head, salt, pepper, and cayenne, two bottles of beer, and long banana leaves. Now tell me how that all goes together to cook a cow head.
Well, the salt and the pepper and the cayenne, that's a rub that we used, and we just loosely sprinkled the salt and the pepper and the cayenne over the meat of the cow head, and then we also put some in the cavities. And then we, what did we do? We got the cow head, and we wrapped it in banana leaves, and then we poured two bottles of beer over the cow head and then finished wrapping it, so it was all, like, enclosed. And then we got two big hotel pans, and we put the enclosed cow head into the hotel pans, and one on top of the other. So it was like, what we were trying to do basically is, you know, the old school way of cooking a cow head in Texas was to do it underground. So we're trying to recreate that by having the banana leaves and the enclosure, you know, just trying to recreate that sort of, I don't know, enclosed sort of experience. And then we go ahead.
Well, was this Elizabeth's recipe then? Did she come up with a way to recreate that experience of cooking it?
Yes, she had never done it before, though, so it was an experiment for all of us.
Oh, now, was she inspired enough to, with, you know, a legal meat, not a cow head, but was she inspired to put something like that on her menu now?
No. I asked them if they would, because Hill Country, I don't know if you're familiar with Hill Country here in New York, but, you know, it's... the man who owns it has connections to Lockhart, and it's a Texas-themed barbecue place. And I said, mm-hmm. you know, the Texans would be so excited to find cowhead barbacoa. But no, it's pretty cost prohibitive. Mm-hmm. And no, I don't think it's going to be on the regular menu anytime soon, unfortunately.
Well, you got a lot of comments. It's almost 100 comments for that particular blog entry. So
oh, really?
You did get a lot of interest in that. Yes, I just checked it today, and I think it's up to 60-something.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, what other kinds of things do you like to write about and inspire cooks at home to do?
I don't know. I mean, I pretty much really do enjoy, I like doing a lot of research on Mexican food. I speak Spanish, so I spend a lot of time reading Spanish Mexican documents and learning more about Mexican, like interior Mexican cooking. That's kind of my latest obsession.
Mm-hmm. Did you know that Diana Kennedy's coming out with a new book?
I did. I think it might already be out in Mexico. It's on Oaxaca, right?
Yeah. It's really hard to find, though. I heard even in Mexico,
really?
It's very difficult to find, and it's in Spanish.
Yeah.
But the University of Texas Press is about to release it in English in the United States sometime later this year.
Oh, very cool. I'll have to get my hands on that.
So and also with your article or with your new column, we're going to have a story on Diana in this issue as well. She goes back and forth to Austin and shops the farmers markets here, and so she's back and forth between Mexico and Austin quite a bit.
Oh, I did not know that. That's great.
So one of the things, Lisa, you are first and foremost a writer, or what is your profession?
My profession, well, the thing that pays the rent, I work at a magazine called Advertising Age. I'm an assistant managing editor there. So, but it's kind of funny because when I was talking to my accountant at tax time, I was like, writer, photographer, and he's like, you can't say that. That's just too weird, he said to you. So you have to pick one or the other. So we went with, I can't remember what he called me. I think it was interactive media specialist or something. But, I mean, the thing is I enjoy both a lot. I've been writing my whole life, and I started taking photos probably about 10 years ago. But, I mean, I've done gallery shows, and I shoot stock photography for Getty. So I enjoy both a whole lot.
I noticed that when you look you up on the internet, you come up as both a photographer and a writer, so you're doing something right there, I think. So do you have a following that you communicate with on a regular basis, or is it sort of random who communicates with you on your blog?
There's always new people coming around, I guess. I mean, you know, I guess when people like Google, you know, that say they're stuck in Norway and they're looking for a flour tortilla recipe, they're probably going to find my blog. And so I'm constantly meeting new homesick Texans. But I would say that there's a core audience that's been with me since the beginning. And it's always, you know, I always see them in the comments and we talk over email. And that's really great. And then also there's the food bloggers, you know, the food blogging community, even if they don't have any interest in Texas food, the food blogging community is just very... It's very warm and it's very generous and it's pretty close knit and we all talk to each other. And so, you know, we all read each other's blogs and support each other. So you've got those two audiences happening.
And do you find that the food blogging community in New York is active in a physical way as well as an online way? Or I know they very much are in Texas, in Austin at least, and that's something I'm going to be talking to our next guests about specifically. But in New York, do you feel that sense of community that grows, you know, from being in actual physical contact with these bloggers as well as online?
A bit. There are like food blogger picnics, and there'll be, especially Brooklyn. Brooklyn has a real big cook-off scene, and a lot of food bloggers get involved with that. I think I guess the longer I've been doing it, I find maybe because it's such a big city that there's, I mean, I don't want to say clicks, but, you know, there are food bloggers that I see on a more regular basis than the whole group because there are just so many New York City-based food bloggers. But we do all know of each other and see each other around at events and things like that. So, I'm aware of how close-knit the Austin scene is. And I wouldn't say that it's as close-knit as that, but that's probably just more of a size issue more than anything.
Mm-hmm. And how do they, in terms of what blogging has, how it's changed in what you write about over the last few years since you've been doing it for a while,
mm-hmm.
have you noticed that you're, besides honing in on actual cooking experiences that you're sharing with both visually as well as in with recipes and experiences and stories that you tell, I mean, there's one another recent blog that you had that was great. You're on your way to an airport in, I think, Birmingham.
Oh yeah.
And you got lost, and as you got lost, you saw a restaurant, and you know your investigative nature, journalism nature probably took over, and you stopped, and then you fell in love with a dish there, and it inspired a blog post. And I did want to ask you, did you miss your plane, or did you catch that plane?
No, but that's just by virtue of the fact that I'm one of those nutso people that probably gets to the airport about 3 or 4 hours early anyway.
Not only were you lost, but you stopped and you had a meal, and then.
And it was actually, I think, my third meal of the day already, too, because I can't remember what it's called, but in Alabama, there's like some biscuit and gravy chain. So I had been there for breakfast, and then there was Whataburger, which we don't have Whataburger in Texas. So anytime I see a Whataburger, I'm going to stop. So I'd already had a Whataburger before I went to Joel's. So
So you'd had a good food trip.
It wasn't like I was even hungry, but it was just like, oh, a meet and three. Because, you know, it's just the kind of thing that you don't experience in New York, and it's just, it's a precious thing, and I want to be able to enjoy it while, you know, I have it when it's available, so.
Well, one of the things I think you do so beautifully in your blog is you find a sense of place, and you've got this kind of skitsy but very, very meaningful connection between Texas and New York and a very different food cultures. Unless you're in an ethnic enclave in New York, of course.
Yeah.
But you really bridge that sense of place, and it's a very welcoming place to go visit. So I want to encourage people, if they have not already experienced homesicktexan.com, and it's homesicktexan.blogspot.com is the actual URL address. But I would strongly encourage people to go visit Lisa. And Lisa, I just want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Marla, for having me. This is a blast.
Great. So thank you.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with Austin food blogging scene makers, Logan and Rachel Cooper.
J'ai travaillé des années sans répit, jour et nuit, pour réussir, eh oui, pour gravir, oh oui, le sommet. En oubliant souvent dans ma course contre le temps. Mes amis, mes amours, mes emmerdes. Accord perdu, j'ai couru, assoiffé, obstiné, vers l'horizon, l'illusion vers l'abstrait. L'abstrait, en sacrifiant ses darons, je m'en accuse à présent. Mes amis, mes amours, mes emmerdes. Mes amis, c'était tout en partage. Tout, mes amours faisaient très bien l'amour. Oh oui. Mes emmerdes étaient ceux de notre âge. Bien sûr. Où l'argent, c'est dommage et peut ronner nos jours. Pour être fier, je suis fier entre nous, je l'avoue. J'ai fait ma vie, mais il y a un mais. Je donnerai ce que j'ai. Pas tout à fait. Pour retrouver. Je l'admets, mes amis, mes amours, mes emmerdes.
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Communities, publisher of Edible Austin, and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and our show today is brought to you by our sponsor, Hearst Ranch. Well, Boots in the Oven is the creation of Logan and Rachel Cooper, a husband and wife blogging team, and one of the most popular blogs covering the food scene in Austin. Welcome, Logan.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Logan, we had to track you down. I know the Boots in the Oven talks about being an orgy of food, travel, and other awesomeness, and I understand you're out in Hawaii right now.
That's right. I'm on Kauai right now.
So, I mean, you sound great.
Thanks.
So we actually have Rachel here in our studio standing by in case we had a connection problem with you, but you're coming through loud and clear. So we're looking forward to talking to you here about blogging.
Excellent.
What inspired you and Rachel in the first place to start your blog?
Well, it kind of had a couple of different inspirations, I guess. One was as a way to keep in touch with family and friends as we traveled around to various places. I think the main reasons we started it, though, is first we'd love to learn about people and places, and we mainly do it through food. It's such a great, you know, window into different cultures and how people live and what they do. And the second part of that is that we'd love to share what we learn with other people and just kind of connect on that level as well. And it just seemed like the perfect outlet to not only be able to be creative and write and do photography, but also to share and to learn. And it's worked out really well.
So how long have you been doing this?
I believe we're at about 4.5 years for Boots in the Oven.
So what inspired the name Boots in the Oven?
Well, kind of came from a brainstorming session. We were sitting around bouncing ideas off of one another, and an old Texas saying came to mind that you can put your boots in the oven, but that'll make them biscuits. Kind of, wish all you want, but it ain't necessarily true. And, of course, it has the reference to boots and travel and an oven and cooking, and it just all seemed to fit together.
What takes you guys on the road so much? What motivates or inspires or employs you to travel?
Well, it's usually just our own desire to go and to keep going. And so we kind of work to travel, and we put a lot of things kind of on the back burner so that we can make that our kind of forefront. It's kind of what we just love to do. I do travel for work. I work in film as a location scout for motion pictures, and I get to travel like that, but that's not nearly the same thing. I'd much rather be on the road, learning about food with my wife and having a great time.
Where are some of the places you guys have gone that were especially memorable that you've shared with your blog readers?
Sure. One of my favorite places that I've ever been is southern Italy, kind of along the heel and the arch of the boot, and then over into Sicily. It's just so unique and different and relatively untraveled as far as Europe goes. And they have such a strong food culture; it's just crazy. And also, kind of the Southeast Asia region. We traveled a bit through Vietnam and southern Thailand, and just fell in love with that, and definitely, I actually came back and announced that we were moving over to Vietnam, and Rachel's like, no, let's, think about that, and, but if I had to pick two places,
when were you in Vietnam?
I guess it's been about 2 years ago, I want to say.
Did you go across the whole length, or were you in one area or the north or south?
No, we unfortunately didn't have as much time as we would like, and we kind of focused on the south, Saigon and the Mekong Delta region.
Mm-hmm. So they have a very vibrant street food culture there.
Yes, definitely. I'm a street food addict, and it was street food heaven. There were just whole streets that were just covered with vendors, and I was like a kid in a candy store running around just buying stuff. I had no idea what it was, and I'm not even sure I was supposed to eat all of it, but it was great.
That's great. Well, closer to home, you guys have made a real impact here in the local blogging, food bloggers scene, and I'm quite amazed at how vibrant this community has become. So I wanted you, if you would, talk a little bit about how you see that evolving and emerging and what you think it's doing for the whole food scene in Austin in general.
Sure. It's amazing how it's really exploded in the last few years. It's great. What's so exciting about it is food is always about community. It really brings people together, and it's a reason to get together, and it's what we do when we get together. And so I just see this as a really great development of that. So there's this whole other community that's developing around local food in Austin. And what's so exciting about it is it's people that I probably never would have met in my regular life, people that I obviously share a real passion with that have left to our own, daily, day-in, day-out work toil, we wouldn't ever meet. So it's great to be able to get together with people and bounce ideas off of them and learn about new things and new restaurants and new food movements. And it's just been really exciting. And the different gatherings that go on and I think it's a real boon to the Austin and Central Texas food community. It's great.
And I imagine that that's happening in communities all over the world with the advent of food blogs and food blogging. And it's great the way with your travel you can tie a lot of those things together. But do you see parallels happening in other places along your travels where you have connected to bloggers before you've gone, or you're connecting with them after you've come back, or anything like that?
Absolutely. Some of the greatest people we've met recently have been developed as online relationships through food and food writing. And then when we travel, we seek them out, and they have their own network of people that they've met locally through the food scene. And it's kind of just this built-in friend network that's great. You know, you don't have to, when you show up anywhere, pretty much you already can have the inside scoop on what's going on, because so many communities are really developing this same kind of networking, this blog network, and it's really great.
So it's a great way to scope out a place either before you go on a trip or to share when you've gone on a trip for people. What are the good places and the fun people and the cool food spots?
Absolutely. They're both of those things. That's half the fun is researching before you go and finding new blogs. And then we actually are, we haven't done it yet, but I'm sure we're going to, there's some bloggers that we really like that I would be tempted to go to, you know, their neck of the woods just because I like them so much and the stuff that they're talking about. It would almost be a great way to plan a trip just based on what you read from people that live in different places.
Well, we have a great edible communities publication out in the Hawaiian Islands called Edible Hawaii.
Oh, really?
And I was wondering, have you had a chance since you've been out there to do much food exploring?
I've been on a tight schedule, but I always try to sneak in as many food experiences as possible. I've been to some good restaurants, but the most exciting thing has been meeting some local people. And I've just found out the most interesting things. I've been I met a really great Filipino man a couple days ago, and we were walking through the woods, and he starts picking up these little tiny prickly fruits, and he was explaining they were wild bitter melon. And he gave me this excellent recipe for stewing chicken and cooking the shoots and cooking the bitter melon, and it was great. You know, I never would have learned that, and I was kind of unhappy that I didn't have a kitchen here.
Wow. Well, you know, there's actually a farmer here in Central Texas that grows bitter melon. Walnut Creek Organic Farm, they're growing it for a couple of Asian restaurants in our area.
Excellent. It's kind of an acquired taste, but I love the stuff. I think it's great.
Well, that's very, very neat. So you're going to be writing about some of these experiences, do you think, on the blog, or is Rachel holding down the blogging fort for you while you're away right now?
She is at the moment, and I know she's excited to hear all about my food experiences over here, and I'm sure she's going to insist that some of it gets on the blog, and I will have to make time, I'm sure, no matter how busy I am. I just wouldn't feel right, you know, not talking about it.
Right. Do you find that it helps to have a partner blogging with you, that you can share some of the perspectives and share some of the time involved in creating a really fine and, you know, a really, really well-done crafted blog?
Oh, it's a huge help. It not only does it make it easier, it makes it 10 times as much fun. I think without Rachel, I would not blog. I wouldn't have ever started a blog. I wouldn't certainly continue it. We play off of each other really well, and she's just such an inspiration, and she helps. You know, we edit each other. We talk about ideas with each other. I think that the blog is definitely a creation of our relationship, and it's not, either one of us would never be able to do it by ourselves.
That is inspiring. So, well, Logan, we're going to have to wrap it up now, but I very much appreciate your taking the time to talk with us, and we're looking forward to doing more shows about food blogging. I think we've really discovered a gold mine of how to connect with food culture in our country and beyond. So thank you so much, and good and safe travels.
Great. Well, thank you. It was fun. Thanks. Bye.
So thanks again to our guests today. I'd like to encourage everyone to go see Julie and Julia, the movie, and watch for Julie Powell's new book about her butchering adventures called Cleaving. Also, thanks to our special guests, homesick Texan Lisa Fain, and Boots in the Oven, Logan Cooper, and vicariously through his blog, you can also meet his wife, Rachel. So you can go to bootsintheoven.com for their blog, homesicktexan.blogspot.com for Lisa Fain's blog, and don't forget theatlantic.com to find Carol Ann Sales' food blog that she does once a week on farming. And again, I'd like to thank everyone for listening today. Please email me and let me know who your favorite food blogs or bloggers are. You can email me at marla@edibleaustin.com. So we'd like to thank our sponsor again, Hearst Ranch, for making the show possible. And next week, your host will be Deborah Shapiro from Edible Green Mountains. I'll be back on September 7th. I'm taking a week off, but I will be back on the 7th of September. But tune in next Monday and every Monday for the Edible Community Show here on Heritage Radio Network.